Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm Sarah Posner, Senior Editor at Blue Jean Dispatches, and my guest today is Sarah Pulliam-Bailey, who's Online Editor at Christianity Today. And we're going to talk about Mitt Romney and President Obama and same-sex marriage and evangelicals and all that good stuff. But let's start with Romney's speech this weekend at his commencement speech at Liberty University. What do you think the reaction from the evangelical community has been to the speech?
So it seemed rather positive. I didn't see much that was terribly shocking from the speech itself that either, it's all about expectations, right? What were we expecting to hear and what did he deliver? And I thought, it was true to expectation. And, it may, I what's unclear to me is how much it'll help him because Liberty, as you know, only represents just a one portion of evangelicals. Obviously, it's a big one, it's a big university. It touches a lot of, a certain segment of evangelicalism, but it's unclear to me how much it'll actually sway those who were, not convinced before, whether it'll, be a tipping point for them. So,
It
what
was
did you think?
funny. Well, it was funny because the New York Times coverage referred to Liberty University as the spiritual heart of the conservative movement, which actually kind of made me laugh because it's just not, I don't think that that's an accurate
No, I don't.
statement
I agree
about,
with you. Well, and what's interesting is Michael Luo of the New York Times tweeted over the weekend, and he made the point, Liberty is just one of many Christian colleges. And if you wanted a more accurate sampling of evangelical colleges, you would need to look at, Wheaton, Calvin, Baylor, Westmont. I mean, there are so many other colleges that are not like Liberty in their, in their student conduct, in their what their expectations in the way they teach science and things like that.
That's right. I mean, there's just countless Bible colleges and seminaries all over the, evangelical seminaries all over the country, and Liberty is just a small slice of that. And I think it has the notoriety because of being founded by Jerry Falwell, obviously. But but I think it's sort of de rigueur for Republican candidates now to go and give a speech there. The other candidates during the primary gave speeches there. Rick Perry did, and Michelle Bachmann did, at least. Did anybody else? I don't remember. I
Those are
remember
the ones
Mich
I remember. Maybe I know Huckabee's, right?
Huckabee has,
Huckabee's.
But Michelle Bachmann's speech that she gave during the primaries to me was much more infused with evangelical language and imagery and discussion of American exceptionalism and weaving that together with her own salvation testimony. And I thought it was an interesting, I actually was fascinated by the speech that she gave there, and I thought it was an interesting contrast to Romney's, which was much more, I thought it was just much more staid and much more kind of safe, what you would expect. And not the other thing that he didn't do, I mean, had he gone the route that Michelle Bachmann had gone, it would have seemed forced and not genuine because he's not an
Right,
evangelical.
exactly. Well,
So,
if I can push back just a little bit, I did think he put out, he used some phrases and he mentioned some individuals, specific individuals that I think will resonate among evangelicals. And maybe those outside of evangelicalism wouldn't necessarily picked up, but he mentioned Bonhoeffer, he mentioned Chuck Colson, he mentioned, I mean, he specifically
Wilberforce,
pointed out these individuals who he wasn't citing Joseph Smith or, Mormon leaders. He was specifically,
that
yeah,
wouldn't
so right, exactly.
have gone
But
over well,
my
I'm sure.
point is, he may not have Bachman's like personal narrative and testimony, and he won't come at it from an evangelical point of view. In fact, he very distinctly said, "Different faiths, yours and mine." Like he acknowledged that there are different faiths, but I think he did, make an effort to use and kind of appeal to that evangelical base.
I think that that's true, and it was interesting. Ed Kilgore, who writes at the Washington Monthly, had a post this morning about the speech, and he specifically talked about how he raised the names of these figures like Colson and John Paul II, even, interesting, a pope, and also Wilberforce and William Wilberforce and John Wesley.
Did he mention C.S. Lewis too? I feel like
and
that
C.S. Lewis. That's right. Yeah. That was the other one.
Yeah.
And I think Kilgore thought that this was very subtle and but in a clever way.
Yes.
And I actually maybe I listened to, you know, for a non-evangelical, I listened to a lot of evangelical. Yeah. Talk. So it didn't seem that unusual to me. Mm-hmm. I thought it was, yes, it was clever if what you're trying to do is reach that audience, because it does ring bells to hear talk about the abolitionist William Wilberforce mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. Chuck Colson, who passed away recently, and C.S. Lewis, obviously. So it seemed like he sort of called, he must have called in a speechwriter who knew,
oh yeah, definitely.
Knew some of the names to
right. Well, I mean, Mark DeMoss had to have a hand in that speech, because there was so much, just the way he talked about service and the way it was very, it just felt like somebody in an evangelical had looked over the speech and said, oh, make sure you know, plug this or plug that. And mm-hmm. the names, as we said, was one of the ways for him to say, okay, I may not become or ever be your evangelical leader that maybe a Huckabee or Bachman would be, but he's able to say, but I look to C.S. Lewis and his writings, or I look to Bonhoeffer and his influence and in Germany and things like that, to say, look, we're all on the same page. We love the same people. We may have different faiths, but, you know, we can all look to these leaders to sort of guide us, if you will. So I thought it was subtle, clever. It may not have surprised you. It didn't surprise me, but it worked, you know, for what it was.
So what do you think the reaction has been, not necessarily by Liberty students, who are obviously not the sole intended audience of the speech, but what do you think the reaction has been among
I can tell
evangelical
all positive.
Leaders?
I mean, I have not seen anyone mm-hmm. who's like, he should have, you know, it converted from Mormonism. I don't think anyone was expecting that, right? You know?
Yeah. Right.
So I think, again, looking at the expectations, thinking about what did we think he was going to say? I mean, he did, I thought it was interesting. I saw some of the reporters kind of act surprised he didn't talk more about marriage. I was actually surprised mm-hmm. He had to kind of nod to it, right? But I didn't think he was going to give this, like, in defense of traditional marriage right in front of, you know, like, these people agree with that. They're not going to be swayed by him but I thought it was interesting he didn't play off of it more, because I think one of the questions was, after Obama's, you know, announcement, he could have used it to whatever his advantage, but he didn't. He just sort of nodded to it and moved on and talked about other things. So, did you expect something different out of that?
Yeah, I expected him to touch on it in some way, just because I think maybe if Obama hadn't made his announcement last week, maybe Romney wouldn't have brought it mm-hmm. up at all. But I think after that, it raised an expectation that he would bring it up. But I think he was trying to walk this line where he wasn't really going to get weighed too deeply into politics, even though that's obviously the reason why he was there. But I think that he probably felt like he had to say something, in part because I think that there are probably still Republican voters who are maybe uncertain or unconvinced of Romney's own position. I wasn't real. I think that there's this conventional wisdom that, and I think it's partially based in truth, in reality, that younger evangelicals just don't really want to hear that much about that. I mean, I think that it was not the sort of thing that, I doubt there are very many people who really wanted to hear that at their commencement speech, you know, at their commencement, that. Even if they agree with Romney and his position being opposed to same-sex marriage.
Yeah, I mean, here's the deal. I went to Wheaton College, and I know that students just wanted some big name. They didn't necessarily care who it was. Like, we had students my year pushing for President Bush to be the commencement speaker, and it wasn't like, there were a lot of students who would have protested that and who would have said, you know, what he's done on the war or whatever is, you know, it would have been sort of a a big mess, probably, and that's probably why they didn't do it. But I think a lot of students are just excited to be like, hey, look, the rest of the, you know, country is paying attention to our school and you know, and sees that I'm graduating from this university where a presidential candidate is going to be. So, you know, the actual message, you know, maybe they would have preferred to hear from a Billy Graham type of person. But I think in general, I think that, you know, I would guess the average Liberty student, as much as we heard in the media, they were, you know, some were protesting or whatever. I think they, I'm guessing the average Liberty student was just pleased that the university has that kind of clout to bring someone that big, you know, to their commencement. So.
And that they didn't necessarily want to hear a big speech about.
Right, exactly. No, and I thought his speech also, too, when I was listening to it, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a graduation. Like, you know, he's trying to encourage them and spur them on to good works and things like that. It's not a policy call to action, vote for me. You know, it had to be delicately presented, I think. So I think one other thing, if I can throw out there, we had a writer, the English chair professor of Liberty wrote a piece for us, and she argued that, you know, as much as some of the students may have been protesting and annoyed by the speech, it was very much in line with Jerry Falwell's vision to work ecumenically across the board with Mormons, Catholics, you know, it just across the board. He would have said, you know, since when did the election become about the evangelical vote? Like, since when did we let it be that way? We work across the board. We talk to Muslims and, you know, and we find common ground either politically or in ministry or whatever in those areas. And the focus on is Mormonism, I thought, was, you know, where the media got caught up. But what Karen was trying to say was, no, this would have been all along in what Falwell would have wanted.
Well, I mean, Falwell was undoubtedly, I mean, he was a political person who wanted his religious perspective injected into politics. And I think I think there was probably a point in his life where he was less interested in doing that in an ecumenical way. As he got deeper into politics, he wanted to do it in a more ecumenical way from the standpoint, you know, sort of like the Francis Schaeffer co-belligerency kind of idea, where, you know, it's like, okay, you're a Mormon, I don't care, because, you know, you share my belief that abortion should be outlawed, or that homosexuality should be outlawed, or whatever the issue was. But I think that that's why the Liberty speeches by politicians do get so much attention, because Falwell sort of considered the architect of injecting these, injecting the evangelical world into politics. But I think, like we were saying at the beginning, that's not the whole evangelical world, or nor is it necessarily the spiritual center of the conservative movement. But I do think that, I mean, I think when people were talking, even back in 2008, about Romney's Mormonism, but also during the ascendancy of Glenn Beck, who also once spoke at a Liberty commencement, and he's Mormon as well, that Falwell was one of the early folks in the religious right making partnerships or political partnerships with Mormons and other Christian, and I consider Mormonism to be a Christian faith, you know, and other Christian faiths, and probably even Jews, to form these political partnerships. So I think that isn't new, but on the other hand, I guess, you know, there was a lot of chatter about a class at Liberty that teaches that Mormonism is a cult and all of that.
Yeah. So. I mean, and you're going to hear that in various places. And then you're going to hear some pushback from people like Rich Mao, president of Fuller Seminary, who's going to say, no, we don't describe Mormons as cults. And so, you know, it just depends either what kind of evangelical you're talking to, what region of the country, how educated they are. Like, you know, all these factors combine into a sense. And, sorry, one other, you know, factor that you have to take into consideration is not just how they view Mormons, but how they view political activism? Is it okay to vote for somebody who doesn't share your beliefs? So, you know, since, you know, we don't have all this discussion about, like, is it okay for us to vote for a Jewish candidate, you know, or, you know, it's
Right.
sort of like, since, you know, why are we not having this conversation over here, but we are having it over here with Mormonism? I think obviously it's new and people are having to grapple with it, and you know, certain people have said certain things and it's sort of causing an uproar, but you do have pushback from people who are saying, well, Mormons are a lot like us in terms of social issues, religious freedom across international religious freedom. You know, they're gonna stand with us on the contraception issue or whatever, whatever these other issues are. They're gonna should say, well, pragmatically, you know, it's better. Wasn't it Martin Luther who said, I'd rather be ruled by, how did he put it? Do you know what quote I'm talking about? Where he's,
Yeah, I do, but now I don't
we'll have
remember
to
the
find that. But
exact
anyway,
phrasing.
you know, some he'd rather be ruled by a smart, you know, non-Christian or whatever than a stupid Christian. I'm horribly paraphrasing it, but I, you know, I think a lot of people would resonate with that.
Well, the other thing that I, having done some reporting at and about Liberty, I think that the view that all of the students there are in this lockstep culture war mentality is not accurate. So I would have expected Romney's people to know that, and therefore would not have expected Romney to do a big culture warrior-ish speech, which is not really, you know. I think he's letting surrogates do that. But, you know, a few years ago, I was at Liberty for the first Freedom Federation conference, and this is a coalition of different religious right groups. That again, it was very much oriented around this broad, it didn't include Mormons, but it did have this kind of broad Christian, intra-Christian ecumenism, where they talked very much about erasing theological differences between them in the service of these political goals. But what was really interesting was campus, it's right there, the conference was right there on campus, and what is it, 10 or 15,000 students there? And there were only a handful of students who even came to any of the events, the biggest one being a kind of revival in the evening. And there were only, I would say at most, you know, a few hundred students there. So it was just notable to me that there didn't seem to be a huge amount of interest in this conference. And then the other experience I had was reporting a story about Liberty Law School and students who were unhappy about the way biblical law versus man's law was being taught to them and in the law school, and how they were dissatisfied with being taught that if quote unquote, you know, man's law conflicted with God's law, that you should engage in civil disobedience and not obey the law of a court or an order of a court. And this was specifically in the context of a very celebrated custody case involving a little girl who had two moms who ended up splitting up. But in any case, you know, I think that I do think that there's people who do go to students who do go to Liberty. They may not be the majority, but who are actually go there. From some of these law students that I talked to, it seemed like they went there and were actually turned off by being fed culture war stuff in the classroom.
I mean, and
So
you're drawing
anyway.
from all sorts of countries, you know, people from all over the world come, you know, missionary kids or whatever, come to Liberty and they're confused or turned off. I think, I don't know if you've read Kevin Roose's book on Liberty, but I feel like there was a section in there that, you know, mentioned just sort of not everyone is in line or, you know, there are definitely internal and external struggles with the university's views on X, Y, or Z. I mean, some of it is sort of accepted or, but you know, here and there you'll find kids who are challenging it or just not choosing to, again, like you said, play the culture warrior type. So.
But, you know, it's funny because, you know, so Romney didn't do that, but at the same time, it seems like there are culture warrior generals, so to speak, who are coming around to backing him. Let's leave Brian Fisher out of the equation for the moment.
Yeah, we should all the time.
but there are other people, Tony Perkins, Gary Bauer, other figures who are sort of considered leaders in conservative evangelicalism who are, seem to be coming around to saying, okay, like, well, Romney's doing and saying the right things here. And yes, you know, Obama's now support of same-sex marriage is really going to energize these voters to come out and and vote for Romney. So while he's trying to stay, well, he doesn't want to talk about, I think he just doesn't want to talk about the same-sex marriage thing because he knows that it's an issue that can play against him. But on the other hand, he's got these surrogates in these positions like Tony Perkins, who are basically saying, you know, Ralph Reed coming out and saying like, this is, I can't remember if it was Ralph Reed or Tony Perkins. One of them said that it was the greatest gift that Romney could have been given, Obama's support for same-sex marriage, because this is going to energize all these voters.
Now Romney doesn't have to energize these even, you know,
Obama did it
exactly,
for him.
Because he was never really good at talking about that.
Do you think
anyway?
He...
So, you know, now if same-sex marriage was so important that you won't, you know, you'll vote on that issue, like Romney doesn't need to like make it an issue, right? I mean, I think that's the argument that Tony Perkins would, you know, could make or whatever. I think what was interesting was I thought maybe this moment at Liberty was, and you know, in this announcement with Obama was the first time that somebody like a Tony Perkins or Gary Bauer was able to say, okay, here's my reason that I can back Romney, you know, because like he's sort of the leftovers, right? Like once Santorum dropped out, I didn't see a whole bunch of conservative Christians, you know, running to endorse Romney. I think they were trying to look, they were looking for a reason to say, okay, finally, okay, fine, we'll back him. Okay, fine. You know, we'll devote some resources to whatever. And I think this, you know, in the last week or so, Obama's announcement, the Liberty Address, sort of gave them, kind of handed them the reason to say, okay, you know, fine, we'll do this, or we'll do what we're going to do.
And was it the Liberty Address itself? What was it, the substance of it, or just the fact that he would go and speak there?
No, I mean, I don't think the substance really, like, floored anyone, right? Like, I don't think anyone was surprised by any of it. I was not particularly or personally surprised that he was going to Liberty itself. I think it just gave them, like, let's say Tony Perkins' constituents are having a hard time with Romney's campaign. Well, now he has a thing, you know, has a speech to point them to, has a, you know, Romney is trying to reach out to us. Now Perkins, I don't think Perkins was ever going to not, you know, devote some resources to helping Romney. But I think now he's able to use this to say to his constituents, like, all right, here's what we needed or whatever. Ever since Santorum that dropped out, that is.
But it's more of an it's still more of an anti-Obama
ultimately.
thing than it is a pro-Romney thing, right? Yeah.
Well, speaking of Obama.
So, let's talk about that. But I wanted to talk about Obama, but I also wanted to talk about what you thought. Do you think that it's really true that there's suddenly going to be this new energy infused into voters who might otherwise maybe would have stayed home? I mean, because I can't imagine that there's anybody out there who was thinking of voting for, or that many people, who was going to vote for Obama.
And who are no longer because.
But then, who are no longer because of this. Because it seems to me that, from a policy perspective, he's already
done a lot of those
things to turn those voters off, right? The refusal to defend, his Justice Department's refusal to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in court. Don't ask, don't tell repeal. There's a bunch of things just on the LGBT issue alone that would have made those voters not want to vote for him.
But here's the thing.
Do you think it's accurate that there's suddenly going to be this huge flood of voters who are going to say, now I'm definitely voting against him?
Well, so here are a few things I think some people have already mentioned, but, you know, we could bring up. Minority voters, you know, how are Black pastors going to handle this going forward, where in 08 it seemed so easy for them to rally their base to get, people to vote for Obama, and now it might be harder. And not just black pastors, but, in general, Hispanic community, minority voters in general, like, it's unclear how it'll impact their vote or at least their public support of Obama. The other thing people have brought up, the voters in swing states, will that make an impact in, say, like North Carolina, where they just voted on that amendment? They just passed that amendment on marriage. And so how is that going to impact in those certain states, Ohio, Wisconsin, et cetera? I had one other final group that I was going to bring up. Because, like you said, I don't think, like, evangelicals were like, oh, now I'm not going to vote for Obama.
Right.
But I do think that in these subgroups that of people who either in specific regions or a certain, race who want to vote for Obama, but, it's unclear to me whether that'll impact the activism for Obama, if they'll have a harder time saying, they may still vote for him in the end, but will they, do the whole, hope change activism?
Will they phone bank? Will they canvass? Will
exactly.
they bring their neighbors
Wait,
to the
right.
polls?
Because I think that could really, if a black pastor is, saying certain things from the pulpit, but then he's saying, on the weekends he's helping people gather for Obama, it's going to be hard, I think, for them, like you said, Obama has been slowly moving this way, but he wasn't really before 08, so it's unclear how it'll impact him in 12 this year.
Right, and I think all of this is calculations at the margins,
yeah.
right? So you're looking at states where it might
yeah.
be decided by a small number
yep.
of votes, and the electoral votes of that state are going to be determinative on the outcome. And I think that there are some, and I guess I just don't have a measure because I'm not a pollster, and I'm not the number cruncher who has all of this at the ready, mm-hmm. right? So, but I think that there's some thinking that Romney really needs to get the white evangelical vote pushed up above 80%. Mm-hmm. Like hovering in the mid-70s isn't going to cut it for some mm-hmm. reason. Must be, some calculation that's been made about, what kind of voter turnout and numbers and percentages really need to, that Romney would really need to beat Obama in certain states. And I think that for the people who are talking about the impact on African-American or Latino pastors and their constituents, they're also thinking about this in terms of being at the margins. Is Obama going to get, 90 or 95% of the African-American
yeah.
vote? Things like that. And so obviously these things can be, those numbers can be determinative, but I just feel like this issue isn't going to be, because there are just so many other things happening and that are going to be on people's minds when they go to the polls. Yeah, sure, there are probably people for whom this is going to be
yeah.
the thing
yeah.
on their mind. But for a lot of people, like we said, they've already decided they're not going to vote
yeah.
for Obama, and this didn't really change the equation for them. And, if you think that Obama's great on, economic issues or immigration or foreign policy compared to Romney, or, if you think that the Republican Party is terrible on, cutting the budget and slashing the social safety net, is Obama coming out in favor of same-sex marriage going to make you vote for the Republicans? It just sort of seems
Well, especially,
it
I think it's important,
for me
especially because Obama said specifically it's not a federal issue for him. If he had, that would have changed the equation, I think, politically, because, what is Obama going to do?
And he got some criticism from the left for saying that it was something that should be left to the
Wait.
States. He got a lot of criticism
right,
from the left
that
for that.
Right, that he didn't go far
not a lot.
Enough,
I mean,
right? I
some.
Thought that was really interesting. And that's one of the points I think a blog made last week was that Obama is not going to get involved in things like Proposition 8 or the North Carolina amendment. He's not going to step in and change these laws that have already been passed. It'll either stay at the state legislative, you know, in the state courts or in the in politics at the state level, Obama making these statements on same-sex marriage is very symbolic, but it's not like it's going to, you know, make sweeping change on gay marriage, and it's not like allowing gay marriage across the board. So I think if it had been more of a federal issue, I think that would have been more of a political decision that people had will have, you know, have to make in November or whatever. But in
right, it was interesting because Jim Clyburn, the assistant minority leader in the mm-hmm. House, this morning came out and said that he thought it should be a federal right. issue, that Obama was wrong for saying it was a state's issue. And so I guess that puts it out there that, you know, there are some Democrats who yeah. think that. But I think that where Obama left it, politically yeah. speaking, he put himself in a place where he doesn't have to say anything yeah. more about it. Right. So he basically said, this is a personal decision that I came to. Politically and legally, it should be left to the states. And that's it. Right. I think the thing that's probably going to get talked about more than state versus federal mm-hmm. is what he said about how his faith informed his decision.
Yeah, because yes, I agree in that I think a lot of people were really interested, you know, and have been very interested in how he talks about his faith. And he's, I can't believe how much he talks about his faith. I can't believe nobody's talking about how much he talks about his faith. And then to use...
I think he talks about it too much, but yeah.
What I'm saying is I you know, if this had been Bush... people would be like, oh my gosh, he's talking about his faith all the time. But, you know, you don't get a lot of coverage after the prayer breakfast or the Easter prayer breakfast of him, how much he talks about Jesus and, you know, personal savior and things like that, that I'm like, whoa, this is, you know, practically, or if not very evangelical type language.
Evangelical, yes, yes. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, so before last week, he talked about this in very... He talked about the same-sex marriage issue, not necessarily in evangelical right. terms, because I think that it's more of a conservative, ecumenically conservative way yep. of framing it. He talked about it in terms of tradition. I think he used the term traditional mm-hmm. marriage and between a man and yep. a woman. And then last week, he says, well, yes, my faith did inform this decision, and I really started to think about it more in terms of the golden rule and treating everybody equally. And I think, you know, every religion reporter in the country, they're, you know, boring.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think for a lot of people, they weren't really thinking about it, that they weren't considering that piece of it that yeah. closely, because it was just the announcement in and of itself was right. the big news. But what do you think, what'd you make of him, A, using faith at all to justify the decision, and then also just the way he framed that. It was very, you know, basic. It wasn't any deep
no,
theological
it wasn't.
Analysis.
I, well, so Terry Mattingly, my boss at GetReligion.org would say, he's uh-huh. just in line with every other, I think he described, you know, liberal mainline Protestant Christian. It's not, you know, like this is, these are the arguments that they use in the mainline church and oh, sorry. And not all mainline churches, but you know, you'll hear this in the Episcopal church or whatever. And so what he's saying is not necessarily out of line with that. What I'm curious is how somebody, I mean, somebody like his spiritual advisor, T.D. Jakes, or Joel Hunter, or Jim Wallis, are going to have to answer to their constituents and say, you know, how are they going to explain that faith element? And what do we do about the golden rule? What do we do about these passages that he's citing? Or, you know, how do we think about that?
Well, that doesn't really get discussed a lot, reconciling that with the idea that... You know, but that's just a completely different framing, right? And I think that there are more complex theological discussions of human mm-hmm. sexuality and what the passages in the Bible that discuss sexuality mean. I think that there is a kind of a more nuanced theological discussion that goes on among liberal theologians beyond just that the golden rule should apply and therefore there should be same-sex marriage because people... you know, people should all be treated equally. in the they're treated equally in the eyes of God, and they should be treated equally in the eyes
Right.
of the law.
Well, you'll see the argument too that no matter what I or my friend or my whatever feel about gay marriage, or sorry, about homosexuality itself as a, you know, sexuality, whether it's nature or nurture or whatever, whatever we believe about that, how do we believe about the state's involvement in marriage? What do we think about, you know, if you're more libertarian, does that mean, you know, you may hold these views about homosexuality, but, well, if, you know, if the, you don't want the government deciding, you know, XYZ is marriage, well, what, you know, what does that do for how the government decides who's married? No matter how you feel personally or theologically about sexuality, I think, you know, you'll see different Christians taking different views about how that plays out politically or, you know, from a policy standpoint.
Right. I think he didn't address, he didn't say, I no longer, did he? Because I think he never said, I don't think he ever said that he thought that homosexuality was a sin.
No.
He just had confined this to marriages between
you
a man and a
Obama?
Woman.
You mean Obama? Yeah, no,
yes.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if he would ever talk about sexuality.
Because, yeah,
again, it's a very much like, how does this play out in real life and how we decide, how the state decides who's, you know, who's able to adopt. And oh, did you know, sorry, not to go on a sidetrack note, but I didn't realize until last week, until, you know, some of the reports about it, that Romney is for, you know, is fine with gay couples adopting children.
Yes, but I don't. I wonder how long he'll be able to get away with that.
Because isn't that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole argument, or one of the big arguments against gay marriage is that it has an impact on kids and society, and if Romney's saying, well, it's okay for gay couples to adopt, isn't that, like, going against the whole, like, argument against gay marriage?
Well, I mean, yeah, from a sort of just a question of the internal logic of it, yes, and also from a question of the opposition of the people that whose support he's seeking, their opposition to same-sex unions or marriages extends
adoption.
To
adoption. Well,
the
that's
adoption
one of the
question.
Biggest reasons why they're, you know, at least that I've, you know, people have told me, like, well, we don't want gay marriage because then, you know, what will that do to kids and adoption and things like that? Well, it seems like Romney is already saying, well, gay adoption's fine, but, you know, forbid marriage.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, that has been one of their quote-unquote religious freedom arguments, that in states where
charities,
same-sex adoptions were made legal, that they claimed that that forced them to shut down their foster care and adoption services, although I would argue that it was their choice to shut it down rather than comply with the law.
Well, regardless of, you know,
it
how
it definitely seems part and parcel of the argument, of the anti-gay argument, anti-gay marriage argument, part and parcel of that is being opposed to same-sex adoption.
Yeah, that's
too.
Why I was surprised to, I, you know, did some digging, and apparently this is not a, like, a new position for Romney, but I was surprised that, it seems like, possibly, like, you know, some of the social conservatives back in 08 were concerned about McCain because he supports, embryonic stem cell research as an extension of, you know, life issues or whatever, and this seems like an extension of gay marriage possibly, but I don't see Tony Perkins or Gary Bauer mentioning this or bringing this up, but I wonder if, you know, if
surely Brian Fisher's brought
it
up, though. That seems like right up his alley to bring it up.
Brian Fisher, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know anybody who listens to Brian Fisher. I mean, I know people do, but I'm just saying, like, the all right. Well, can we talk about a little bit
about
said about
him, the better, right?
About the pat. What I your argument I thought was interesting when you were saying, so, you know, Obama, after making this announcement, had the New York Times has reported that he called Joe Hunter, he called Jim Wallace, he's calling these pastors. What you were trying, I think, making the point was, for those who are really a new evangelical in the sense that, you know, they care about the environment or they care about poverty and these other issues, like,
right.
Is gay marriage actually going to be an issue for them anyway? Or is it going to be, you know, one of the primary issues that, you know, they're going to vote on? I thought that was an interesting point. If, you know, if we're like, how big of a swath do we think the new evangelicals, the Rich Cizik, the Jim Wallace's, how, you know, how much do we think they make how percentage wise, you know, what do they make of evangelicals anyway? But, I thought that was an interesting point.
Well, you know, I was arguing also that Obama had sort of painted himself into a corner, so to speak, because he reached, you know, there are pro-gay marriage pastors and religious leaders out there. There are lots of them.
But are they going to reach the
audience? He knows, you know, they're going to vote for him anyway, right? So what he was trying to do by surrounding himself with people like Jim Wallace and Jill Hunter and other people who one might expect I would expect Jim Wallace to be a Republican, but, you know, Jill Hunter, yes, you know, and
or at least they're willing to, you know, hear both sides or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
but now he's in this position of like, okay, well now what do I do? Because I've made these people my spiritual advisors, or that's the terminology that apparently someone in the White House wanted the press using. That they were his spiritual advisors, and now he's done this thing that runs counter to what they believe, right? So for someone like Jill Hunter, I mean, he's pretty, it's not like he's one of these people who's kind of on the fence and getting there about
same-sex
marriage.
No, he's not going to evolve with Obama, that's for sure.
No, yeah, he's not evolving. He knows where he is, and he's right? And
yeah, well, if I could push back just a little bit on that point, on that specific, you know, I already said I enjoyed the point that you made earlier on the new evangelicals, but, you know, when you're describing these pastors like Jim Wallace, Jill Hunter, I thought actually it was smart on Obama's part to reach out to them because they are more likely to say to their audience with credibility, okay, he may believe something different about same-sex marriage, but it's not on the priority list for us. Like, poverty is above that. Or, you know, they're able to say to an audience that may not otherwise vote for Obama or would struggle to, or, you know, have these, or maybe they, you know, maybe Jim Wallace's crowd would, you know, would go out and campaign for him. I'm not sure. But I thought, you know, from a strategic point of view, that it was, you know, it made sense for Obama to reach out to them and continue to explain to them when he has to do something like contraception, you know, the contraception mandate, he's gonna need Jill Hunter to explain to, you know, these people to calm them down or whatever, you know, whatever he has to do. Jill Hunter is gonna have much more of an ability to bring that message than, you know, a Methodist pastor or you know, PCUSA pastor or whatever. They're just going to have a little bit more credibility because they're willing to talk kind of on both sides to some extent.
But I guess my question is, yeah, he has an audience and he has credibility, but how much are they listening? I mean, does it matter? Does it actually have any kind of impact on his audience, or, you know, maybe not his audience, like people sitting in his pews, but people who might otherwise listen to what he has to say on television or at a conference or something like that.
I think it's going to have more of an impact than, you know, a pro gay marriage pastor if on this particular issue. I think he's going to be able to say, look,
it's okay to vote for
exactly.
him anyway.
I think he's going to have the ability to say, look, I'm with you on this issue, but let's look beyond that or whatever, you know, however he's pitching it. So one thing I was wondering why you describe them as anti-gay pastors instead of something like anti-gay rights or.
Well, you know, I think that it is anti-gay to be opposed to same-sex marriage and to say that, you know, people shouldn't have the same rights as everybody else. I mean, I think that it's a. it's a dodge to frame it in terms of religious freedom and say that, well, you know, this is the way the Bible intended it, and if we let gay people get married, then this infringes on our religious liberty. I think it's an anti-gay position to be anti-same-sex marriage and to try to get away with it by saying that this is what your religion requires and your religious freedom requires you to take that position and make sure that it's not quote-unquote imposed on you, even though same-sex marriage laws that have passed in state legislatures have exemptions that don't require, that are explicit about not requiring houses of worship to have to perform or otherwise participate in same-sex ceremonies if it runs counter to their religious beliefs. So I think that those protections are sufficient. You know, nobody is going to make, I mean, nobody makes a, you know, nobody makes a rabbi perform an interfaith wedding ceremony. You know, the state is not going to come in and say, oh, well, this, you know, Jewish woman and a Christian man came and said that they wanted you to marry them, but you can't do it because you won't do it because both of them aren't Jewish. The state doesn't make them do it. So I think that there's a lot of, you know, scare tactics around the idea that somehow this is going to force religious people to act contrary to their religious
beliefs. Well, regardless of, you know, whether people are using this to, you know, say whatever about religious freedom, it just seems like adding something like, again, anti-gay rights or anti-gay marriage or whatever would add a little bit more specificity to what is Joel Hunter, you know, because I'm sure Joel Hunter has gay congregants in his congregation, you know, who he probably talks to and probably has relationships with them and friendships with them. And if that makes sense, I guess I felt like, you know, sort of similar to the calling someone who's pro-choice or against or for legalization of abortion, like, you know, the way we talk about how, you know, how we frame it is interesting. You know, do we call them anti-choicers because that's the issue, whether it's a choice or not, or do we call it, you know, specifically opposed to criminalizing abortion or however you, you know, say it, but,
yeah.
Anyway, that's the choice, you know.
Yeah, no, I hear your point. I hear your point, but, yeah, like I already explained what my thinking was on that. So, let's finish up with just a discussion about this idea that the, views on same-sex marriage are kind of generational, that it's older voters who are against it and younger voters who are fine with it. And I think that that's been shown by polling data, you know, just kind of across the board when it's not broken down by religion or race. If you just look at it broadly, just by age groupings, it's, I can't remember what the differences are, but they're stark and they're
huge. Tobin Grant and I did a piece for Christianity Today, especially looking at evangelical attitudes towards same-sex marriage, but we also compared it to the, you know, not born again category. And from this graph, it looks like opposition to same-sex marriage among 18 to 35 year olds who are not born again is 12%. I mean, that is really low.
Wow.
Right? And then
you
compare that to people who self-describe as born again and who are 18 to 35, and that's at 44%. So, you know, there's a pretty different age
opposed
gap.
To it.
Or sorry, not age gap, but if you are born again, obviously it's going to make a huge difference on your views on same-sex marriage. And then also if you take that, extend that even further, if you're 36 or over, you are 63% chance of being against same-sex marriage, which is compared to...
Regardless of your religion.
No, this is born again. Born again believers are 63% opposed to gay marriage. And this is according to the General Social Survey. And we explained in the piece how you ask about gay marriage really makes a difference with the poll data.
Right.
So you can have like a 12-point swing depending on how you... If you ask gay marriage as a... If you phrase it as sort of a right, it's going to be very different from if you phrase it as... should states allow gays to marry or something, you know, something like that.
So people are more in favor of it if you frame it as a
Exactly.
right, as a like a civil right issue. That's
Very much so,
interesting.
yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you are not born again, you and you're 36 or over, you are 38% of those are opposed to same-sex marriage. So again, you know, religion has a big part of this. And what we also thought was interesting was, you know, obviously people said a lot for a long time, like we're shifting generation. You know, in the last 10, 20 years, we're seeing this huge shift. In 1988, born again believers, opposition to same-sex marriage was at 85%, compared to now it's like 64% is what, or 63% is what I said, compared to now, you know, it's or even 2 years ago it was at 60%. And then if you
Well,
were
so what?
not born again in 1988, you were opposed to same-sex marriage at the same level that evangelicals are today. So,
So there's been these big changes in the non-evangelical
oh, huge.
population. Will there come a point, huge changes, right? Will there come a point where the evangelical, and obviously, you know, it's not monolithic that, so you're saying 44% of born again respondents who were between the ages of 18 and 35, 44% of them were opposed to same-sex marriage. So it's not even a majority. It's, you know, it's shrinking down
It
to
is,
a
yeah.
sizable minority, right? But sizable. Will there come a point where, I mean, do you see a rift within evangelicalism where there will be, you know, this what where what will remain 10 years from now? Are inclusive LGBT inclusive churches like J.
Well,
Baker's,
does I
just
mean,
a random
would other
example, and
evangelicals
then,
see Jay Baker's church as evangelical?
well, there's that question. Okay, let's take a different question. But do you think that there will be a noticeable split where evangelicals will no longer be as unified on this issue as they once
I
were?
mean, with any cultural change, I think we will see some differences. The question I have is whether it'll be like, you know, if you're, say, LGBT friendly or however you want to put that, are you just going to switch over to the mainline church or is your church going to adapt with those changes? You know, does that make sense? Like, are you just going to become.
Yeah, and I guess that's maybe more my question. Is it, are there going to be churches who adapt to the changes, or would the pressure to not be LGBT inclusive be too intense?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you the answer to that because, you know, 30 years ago, did people think that evangelical churches would allow women's ordination? I, you know, a lot of churches still don't,
And some still
right? You
don't.
know, so I mean, the Southern Baptist Convention's what, the third largest religious denomination in the country, and I don't see the Southern Baptist changing anytime soon. You know, if anything, they will be the last stronghold. So, you know, I do see a coming, you know, if not generational, but maybe cultural. I don't know if there will be a year where, you know, we'll see just it's too obviously split down the middle. You know, it's unclear. Will churches split over this? You know, they already have, right? Within the Episcopal Church, and will we see that within evangelicalism? I don't know that it's going to be as obvious as it was with the mainline
Because there
church.
aren't the denominations, I think that within, you know, the Episcopal Church and within, you know, there was the fight that went on within the United
Right.
Methodist
Still
Church
going
at their
on, right?
convention recently about whether to take the language out of their book of discipline that says that homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching, and they voted not to take it out, so it's still in there, and there's, you know, sort of an ongoing battle over that. But, you know, the evangelical world, I mean, apart from some, there are some denominations, but a lot of the evangelical churches are
Exactly.
non-denominational.
That's why I
So
think it won't
what kind of
be.
split would there
I think
be?
it won't be as obvious as it was with the mainline churches because we evangelical churches, you know, they don't even own their own buildings a lot of times, or they, you know, they're like renting out schools, so it's not like they're going to have this big court battle over. You know, I don't, but what I am curious is how will it affect the mega churches, you know? Like that's one thing that I think will be key. How will, you know, Rick Warren's church have to adapt, or will it adapt, or, you know, what will it do?
Yeah.
Did you happen to see the buzz about Andy Stanley? He's a pastor in Atlanta.
Yeah, I don't. Okay. I know who he is, but I didn't.
So this little buzz is a recent sermon illustration he gave. My understanding is that he specifically pointed out like a divorced couple and a gay couple, and he didn't, you know, go out of his way to sort of condemn this gay couple. And so people like Al Mohler, Denny Burke, they're kind of chastising him, saying he's not being explicit enough, not speaking on homosexuality enough. And, you know, Andy Stanley, to my knowledge, has not really addressed their concerns. And so, you know, this isn't, you know, this is a question of mega churches and how they try to reach out to as many people as possible, but also, you know, as Mueller might say, stand their ground on these issues.
Yeah.
Do you see a coming battle or a coming...
I don't know. I mean, I feel like that it could just be a question of alienating younger, if there's too much focus or talk of this, that it would alienate the pro same-sex marriage people in the churches to go to a different church if there was, you know, so it might make the possibility of inclusive churches more possible if there's more demand for them, right? Or it might just turn them off to church at all, and they might just, you know, not go or do Bible study with some friends, or, you know, that sort
of thing. One thing that I think we can't forget is the issue of abortion, right? Like, the population is going more, Gallup wording, I think, is more self-identifying as pro-life or whatever. I think a lot of, you know, a lot of evangelicals might even consider, who feel a certain way on gay marriage or on LGBT issues, might consider the Episcopal Church, but they may not be able to bring themselves because of how the pastor stands on abortion or whatever. So that's, I think, combining those two issues are fascinating. I know, you know, people say, oh, evangelicals are more about those two issues, but more than just those two issues. But I think those, for a lot of people, you know, say a lot about marriage, life, ethics, you know, those kinds of things that, you know, can you pick one, you know, take one side on one and a different side on the other and find a church that agrees, you know, with your particular point of view on those?
Yeah, that's another question. I mean, you know, and related to our discussion before about whether having somebody like Joel Hunter talking on Obama's behalf is actually helpful. You know, in a previous Blogging Heads, I had Matt Anderson, who blogs at New Orthodoxy, talking about this. And, you know, I was saying, well, you know, are there deal breakers for younger evangelicals voting for a Democrat like Obama? And I said, you know, well, what about abortion? And he said, yeah, you can stop right there. Yeah. That's it. Right. Yeah. And so in a way, you know, the whole same-sex marriage thing doesn't matter because in that sense.
It's not going to like electoral change. Sense. Like, all of a sudden people are going to, you know, necessarily go one way or the other because they may have felt this way about Obama's views on abortion anyway.
Right. So, well, this is fun.
Thank you, Sarah. It's fun to talk to you.
Thanks for doing it.
Talk to you later.
Okay.